was Barack Obama speaking in 2005 when he was a U.S. senator, speaking about national security letters. Ladar Levinson, I know you can't say if you've received a national security letter, but what are your thoughts on hearing this?
I think it's important to note that, you know, it's possible to receive one of these orders and have it signed off on by a court. You know, we have the FISA court, which is effectively a secret court, sometimes called a kangaroo court because there's no opposition. And they can effectively issue what we used to consider to be an NSL. And it has the same restrictions that your last speaker, your last guest, just talked about.
And Nick, can you talk about the work around privacy that you're doing today? And if you were shaping policy on internet privacy, what would it look like to you?
One of the points that we're trying to make is that the concern about cybersecurity and the concerns about privacy are really two sides of the same coin, and that there are a lot of really uncontroversial examples in which organizations and people need confidentiality. Medicine is one, journalism is another, human rights organizations is an obvious third. We're trying to make the case that if the right of Americans to encrypt their data and to have private information is taken away, that it's going to have grave, far-reaching effects on many kinds of industries, on our democracy as a whole, and our standing in the world. There's also been a study recently saying that the government's policies weakening the right to privacy and the right to use encryption is going to cost American cloud service providers upwards of $35 billion over the next few years. So I think it's going to have really terrible economic effects. And these are some issues that we need to consider when we look at the policies that the government is taking.
Ladar Levinson, you've shut down LavaBit. What would it mean if Google and Microsoft and Yahoo took a similar stand?
I think a major portion of the U.S. economy would shut down with it. Now, whether that would cause Barack Obama to reconsider his policies, I don't know.
You think of the web blackout protesting SOPA.
Yeah. Yeah. But those didn't actually shut down. Well, they did shut down services, some non-critical services for a day. But that was more of a visual protest. Our economy depends upon email. And more now than ever before, it depends upon Gmail, because Gmail is used to host so many corporate email accounts. Along with Outlook 365, which is the Microsoft service, Microsoft cloud service. And those shutting down would effectively force millions of Americans to find a new way to communicate.
Well, we have to leave it there. Unfortunately, Ladar Levinson, mm-hmm. thank you very much for being with us, has just decided to shut down his service provider, his LavaBit. Jesse Banal, attorney, and Nick Merrill of the Calix Institute. That does it for the show. I'm Amy Goodman with Aaron Matzek. Democracy Now! Is a listener-supported grassroots global news hour. You make it possible when you donate at democracynow.org. Thank you so much.
This is Bob Longman at WUSB Stony Brook with your concert billboard for Wednesday, August 14th. The Tommy Keys Band will be at the VA Medical Center in Northport, 6:30 p.m. Caitlin Amanda and the Enablers will be enabling Harborfront Park in Port Jefferson at 6:30 p.m. Buddy Miriam will be at the Mirabelle Tavern at Three Village Inn in Stony Brook. The Ad Lib Street Orchestra will be at Agawam Park in Southampton at 6:30. Ambient Chaos presents the Kako Harmonic Convention at the Spectrum in New York City. Glenn David Andrews will be at the Fairfield Theater Stage 1 in Fairfield, Connecticut, 7:45 p.m. And the Smoking Rockets will be at Big Daddy's in Massapequa, 7 p.m. Your concert billboard for Thursday, August 15th. The Fastlane will be at the Harborfront Park in Port Jefferson, 8 p.m. Inda Eaton, Hugh Prestwood, and Carolyn Doctorow will be at the Suffolk Theater in Riverhead, 8 p.m. Risky Business will be at the Smithtown Library Lawn in Smithtown, 8 p.m. The NYCB Theater at Westbury presents Lynyrd Skynyrd at 8 p.m. at the 89 North and Patchogue, Black Root, Black Jacket, Emotion Picture, and Mental Operation, starting at 7. At K.J. Farrell's, the Toby Tobias Ensemble and Robinson Treacher, and that's at 7:30 in Belmore. Frank Fairfield will be at the Grey Horse Tavern in Bayport, 8 p.m. Shecky and the Twang Tones will be at Fadley's Deli Pub in Patchogue, 6 p.m. Tune in throughout the day, each day, to hear Concert Billboard on the air, or see it at the WUSB website at wusb.fm/CBB. It's a service of WUSB Stony Brook.
Yeah, thank you, Bob, and thank you for the beautiful music in the background there. It is currently 6:02, almost 6:03 in the p.m. right here on WUSB Stony Brook, and that can only mean one thing on a Tuesday night.
And you are listening to WUSB Stony Brook. It's time now for Off the Wall. Thank you. And a very good evening to everybody. The program is Off the Wall. Emmanuel Goldstein here with you. Tonight is the start of a two-part show that focuses on our visit to the monks of Newskeet back in early March. What's unusual about these Eastern Orthodox monks in upstate New York is that they spend their time raising German shepherds. And in this week's show, Kyle and I start driving northward on a dark and empty road in the middle of the night, discussing monks and monasteries, but mostly we just talk about dogs.
They were all made of wood. Well, they were wooden trees, and they were made entirely of wood. Your shirt was on fire, and your hair was on fire, and flames were licking all around your feet. And I did not know what to do. And then a thousand violins began to play. I really did not know what to do then. So I just decided to go out and, walk the dog. I went to the movies. And I saw a dog 30 feet high. And this dog was made entirely of light. And he filled up the whole screen. And his eyes were long hallways. He had those long hallway eyes. On the radio, and I heard a song by Dolly Parton, and she was singing, wow, I feel so bad, I feel so sad, I left my mom and I left my dad, and I just want to go home now. I just wanna go back to my Tennessee mountain home now. Well, you know she's not gonna go back home. And I know she's not gonna go back home. And she knows she's never gonna go back there. Yeah. just want to know who's going to go and walk her dog. Her dog. Well, I feel so bad. I feel so sad. But not as bad as the night I wrote this song. Close your eyes. Okay. Now imagine you're at the most wonderful party. Okay. Delicious food. Uh-huh. Interesting people. Uh-huh. Terrific music. Uh-huh. Now open them.
So we're on the Taconic State Parkway after a bit of bewilderment finding it. It's a great road that heads north. There's no lights, there's no trucks, and there's hardly any cars. There are some deer, though, I got to be careful of. It's nighttime. No tolls, either. Did I mention that? No tolls at all. And it's actually faster to get where we're going, Kyle, why don't you tell the folks where we're going right now? We're not going there right now, but it's our ultimate goal. We'll get there tomorrow.
Yeah, we're going up to Cambridge, New York, to the Newskeet Monastery. And actually, I don't know a whole heck of a lot about their history and all that. I mean, I do in sort of a colloquial way, but there's a lot of details, I'm sure. But basically, it's a monastery that's been breeding and raising German Shepherds. The monks breed and raise German Shepherd dogs, and the nuns live down the road, and they do a lot of baking. And I'm sure they're very well involved with the breeding program, but monks of Newskeet are really famous for their training and their handling techniques, and they were so renowned and so sought after that they began a breeding program probably like in the 70s, I want to say, but it could be earlier than that. In any event, for my entire life, they've been very active, and my parents were dog breeders and trainers the entire time that I was growing up and before I was grown, and so when I was a young person, a lot of my responsibilities around the house, aside from regular chores when you're a kid, revolved around dogs. And I had a lot of unique experiences with that, including dog breeding and whelping and experience with veterinarians and animal health and caring for, you know, animals and caring for beings that are creatures that, you know, are helpless and all these kinds of lessons. I can go into it more.
What is whelping?
Whelping is the process of birthing puppies.
Oh, wow.
So when you whelp a litter, you're creating a sort of a nest for a pregnant dog, a bitch, as it were. And when the bitch is in heat, she's not whelping because she doesn't have pups. So that's sort of a different thing, the whole breeding process. When she's in heat, that means she's ready to be bred, and then there's the pregnancy, which I don't know how many months it is. It's less than humans. I want to say it's like maybe 5 months, but I could be wrong.
Yeah, something like, well, when my dog Walter was born, I don't know if this makes me someone who did whelping as well.
You might have.
Well, basically, we didn't really do very much. We knew that his mother was pregnant.
Right.
And we just basically made sure that we were around and comforting the dog and all that.
Yes.
Didn't really do anything other than that. And, well, the thing that we did, this is kind of funny, actually, we saw the first puppy come out, and then we were just waiting around for the next one to come out.
Right.
And we just didn't know what to do. We just figured it's going to come at some point.
Yeah.
Never came. Walter was a litter of one.
Right.
And I don't know, maybe you can tell me, how often does that happen with dogs where there's only one puppy?
It can happen, but bitches can tend to have consistent litters. Like, if the dog has had several puppies, like maybe she has six, she'll generally always have six. They'll be fairly predictable, but it's really important, and something I know from the way my parents handled breeding, because there's sort of a whole spectrum within breeding of how people do it, but is that you get at least one x-ray during the pregnancy so that you can count the spines and find out how many pups there actually are, so that when you're whelping not whelping, but you're actually handling the birth of the puppies, monitoring it, I guess. That's part of the whelping process, yeah. So when you're whelping, you can count how many come out and make sure everybody's accounted for and alive and that kind of stuff. And you know how many more to expect before maybe taking her to the vet and having them intervene for a puppy that's stuck, because, you know, there's all kinds of complications just like in a human birth, and the doctors can help move that along, and they can also remove any problematic stuff, including like stillborn pups and stuff like that, because that can be very hazardous to the mother, just as it would be in a human pregnancy.
Well, in hindsight, I guess that would have been the best way to go around, but...
I understand.
Walter's mother, whose name, by the way, was Reuther, and in fact, the two of them were named after the famous labor leader, Walter Reuther, who has a statue in Wheeling, West Virginia. His mother, Reuther, gave birth to a second litter many years later, or a couple of years later anyway.
Right.
And that litter had 11 puppies, so... as far as consistency, Reuther was not consistent, unless... there always had to be ones in the number or something like that.
That's funny. Well, there's also a lot of chance and environmental factors and health and different things that
I'm sorry. Did you see what we just passed? Donald J. Trump's state park.
Yeah.
He has a state park? Why the hell does that jerk have a state park?
What doesn't that guy have?
Wow. You know, I feel like turning around just so I can urinate on it.
You know, I get Trump and who's the guy in the wheelchair? That runs
Stephen Hawking?
No, that runs Hustler.
Oh, Larry Flint.
Yeah, I get Flint and Trump messed up all the time. I used to when I was little.
Well...
now, I mean, they're both tacky jerks, but...
yeah, but one's a rich tacky jerk, and the other one is basically... well, he made the movie, or the movie was made about him. The People versus Larry Flint. And I don't think he has as much money anymore.
Well, probably, but he started Hustler, and he'll... I don't know. Whatever. Anyway.
Whereas...
I'm just saying they're both...
Donald Trump is a hustler.
Tasteless jerks.
Granted. Agreed.
Anyway, go on. Yeah, he has a park. Whoopee.
Well, that's it. I just noticed that. I'm kind of shocked.
So, yeah, what were we talking about?
Well,
monks.
Yeah,
and,
we should go back to the monks, because we started talking about dogs. And, yeah, you've been involved in German Shepherd breeding for much of your life.
Totally.
And now we're going to a monastery, which... is where this kind of thing happens. And I've never heard of a monastery that breeds German Shepherds.
Isn't that interesting?
I've never really been to a monastery either. And I've never been to a kennel, so I guess the two together, killing two birds with one stone, if that's an appropriate phrase to use here.
Sure. And it's absolutely... It's sort of something I've realized that has had a profound impact. Actually, just in the past like couple months, I've been thinking about it, because... a lot of things are changing in my family and the way our kennel is and was. It just brings back fond memories, and I think I got a lot out of it, more than met the eye, especially when I was a teenager and I wanted to go do what other teenagers, you know, get out there and do my own thing. You kind of reject the chores and responsibilities as, I don't know, any Amish kid or whatever kid on a farm might do.
Well, I mean, it was like on a farm. You woke up at the crack of dawn.
Yeah.
Like, what do you have to do?
So our dogs were indoor-outdoor dogs. Basically, my mom... imagine your mom or your father and your... imagine your family, like, they refer to this one book or this one training method. Because it's just like with people, you know, you want to get a lot of literature if you're going to be a breeder. And, you know, so you read a lot, you read a lot of magazines, you get involved in the culture. And so my mom always referenced this book. And that was part of the interest of going up to Newski. But basically, the training techniques and obedience stuff is what that would be about. But that was only a small part of what it really was for me, as far as responsibilities and daily tasks. So I'm sort of researching this thing that was referenced as a part of obedience and training, and that's the impetus for me wanting to explore and see what the monks are all about, aside from actually being interested in some of the spirituality and what they're all about in their daily lives, and seeing a really well-run kennel. So our kennel was very small, And it was at two different houses that my parents had when we were growing up. And basically the daily routine is, as I said, our dogs are indoor-outdoor dogs. So we had outdoor kennels that were sort of chain length, and either at first they had sawdust, and then we moved into like pea gravel, which is a little bit better surface for keeping the hygienics of the kennel up. And so those kennels were outside, and we would bring them inside and keep them in the garage in like sky crates. They're like plastic crates that you would use for air travel or transporting a pet. And so they would sleep in those at night. And our parents got like the biggest sky crates you could get. They're called sky kennels because they're used in air travel a lot. But we would get the 500 or 600 series sky kennels, which are huge. And we'd put beds in there, so they had some nice soft beds. And that was where they stayed, in the garage. But you can't leave the dogs in. You can't leave a large breed dog in an inside through the night. You have to let them out to eliminate and get fresh air, and they of course need to be fed and watered and stuff like that. So the routine was basically to bring them in at night, and then every morning let them out, clean their water buckets, which got dirty during the day, especially because we live near an airport and stuff. So we would clean their water buckets. I would clean their water buckets every day, and mix up food for them. Generally, it was like dry food, but sometimes we would mix leftovers or fats that we skim off of different meals, because you can blend it with the dry food, and it's actually really good for their coats and keeping them healthy. And sometimes we would use wet food when I was growing up, but we moved away from that. I think dry food is generally the best stuff for dogs, unless they're getting leftovers or something sort of mixed in. Sometimes you can add water to it, especially older dogs, to make it a little softer, so it's a little mushier. But that was it. It's basically let them out, water them, get them fresh water and fresh food, and then there's cleaning. And cleaning is an interesting thing. It's basically you take like a small shovel and a little rake. And they're called pooper scoopers, actually, sometimes. And basically you scrape all the droppings from the previous day. And, you know, depending on your life and what comes up or who was responsible before, you might clean up stuff that's older. And that's where you got to think about the spectrum. I mean, there's a lot of different type of kennels. Sometimes there could be leavings from, like, a week old. I mean, there's some dirty, dirty kennels in the world, and I always felt like my parents and what I, my responsibility was to keep it hygienic and do as best, as good a job as we can, because just them getting out and getting fresh air isn't enough. There's this whole other attribute of socialization and training and love and, you know, interacting with dogs, and that can go downhill really quickly, especially if the hygiene isn't there. But once you have that, if you have a kennel of 14 dogs or 10 dogs, it's pretty hard to spread the attention, right? And each dog needs to feel like they have a family. And there's real hygienic kennels that do not provide adequate socialization and love and human contact. And they can breed some pretty mean dogs, even if it's, you know, well-maintained and clean. So you can kind of get that there's a lot of room for error and a lot of room for inhumane treatment, basically. And things fluctuate, and our family always did the best we could, and I think we ended up having a really well-run kennel. And basically that became my responsibility, is the hygiene of no matter how many puppies or dogs we have. And you know, that lasted through several, many, many litters. I can't even count. I don't even know how many litters. My mom could tell you, because she's got all the bloodlines and all the information about it.
But did you mention what, how early you had to get up and all that stuff?
No, I didn't. Oh my gosh. Yeah. So before, all of that was done before sunrise. when I was in charge. Sometimes it would go late, you know, into 10 o'clock or midday, but I like to get all of that done and the dogs out before sunrise. So I would get up at like 5. It depends on the time of year, too, depending on when sunrise is. But you don't want to leave them in till like 10 or midday because it's already really hot outside. They may have soiled their indoor kennels and that kind of thing. And that's really unhygienic because then their coat is full of, you know, waste, and that can be unhealthy for a dog. So it's really important, and I always felt, to have them get up and get out really early. And you want to go with the light cycles, too. You know, at sunrise, it is light, and it's daytime. So animals want to be out there. They don't want to be in their den. They want, it's psychologically, it's, I think, important. So I prided myself on having everything clean, everything watered, everything ready to go before sunrise. And oftentimes, especially in high school, I had to be at school by like 7:40 or whatever. So that all had to be done and ready to go before we commuted to school. I went to a school a bit farther away than where we live. So, but that was a little bit later. But, you know, that's a general pattern of it. And I took more and more of that on, basically because I had to, because it was expected of me, but also I became more interested in doing a good job, and I cared about the animals, even if I only saw them little bits of time per day. They knew I cared about them, and really over time I was a huge part of their life. I may not spend hours and hours with them, but they saw me every day and I fed them every day, that kind of thing. So it's a lot to think about, and there's a lot of, I don't know, a lot of interesting stories that I look back on it, and I'm interested in, now that I've sort of been away from it, I've been traveling around a bit, and I'm out on my own, sort of creating my own life. It's interesting to look back on, and, you know, I want to get a little insight, and so I think visiting a kennel like this, and seeing some people that are really spiritually devoted to this, could be interesting for me, because I eventually became really spiritual about what I did with regard to taking care of our animals and stuff like that.
How would you say you've been spiritual as far as animals go?
Wow. I think it's communication. I think it definitely. So basically, I've only been exposed to one breed, basically German Shepherds, and they're a very intelligent breed. And when you've had a relationship with a German Shepherd, they know you. I think you could probably say this, I mean, with any dog, they know you really, really well. But they're a very, very, like, emotive and sensitive animal, but very intelligent. And I felt devoted to it, I think, to doing the work and to being out there. And I think there's a connection with taking care of the animals and then the reciprocation in, like, psychologically what they provide you, companionship, like loyalty, protection, different things like that. There's a symbiosis there, and there's like a grounding in nature, because they can smell things, they can hear things, they're really in tune, and it makes you very in tune, I think. You listen, and you are aware as them. You see what they're looking at. A lot of animals are like that, but I grew very deeply, connected to what a German Shepherd brings to you as far as walking this earth every day. When you live in a household, or when you're in suburbia, or and we were sort of at the urban interface. We didn't really live out in the country ever, and we didn't really live in the city. In fact, our house, our first neighborhood sort of got built out. It used to have a huge horse pasture, but it turned into like 64, you know, houses in like a housing development. So, and that was like during my birth, like during my childhood after I was born. So I sort of experienced a bit of sprawl even in my neighborhood, and yet through that, like, we still had animals and that kind of thing. And you realize how much animals are dependent and helpless in a lot of ways. And I think that gave me a lot of insight as to, like, how to interact with other people and other creatures, and understanding that there are weak people that are weaker than you, and you can be, or creatures, not just people, but creatures that are weaker and dependent in the world, and stewardship of that is shepherding. That is, you know, your flock, and that's a lot of, that has some spiritual ties in Christianity, just the language alone, but it's also simply like a humanitarian kind of attitude of, it is an analogy for the kind of world we live in, that as Americans we're very well off, we have a lot, and there's a lot of need even in our own communities, but in the greater world as well. Definitely gets you out. It gets you out in the morning very early, like you're seeing the sunrise with these animals, you're getting fresh air. That's counterintuitive. A lot of people just get in their cars immediately when they leave the house in a day. They don't get out first thing every morning. My entire life was pretty much, all right, get out of bed and go outside, and that's where you are. That's where you belong on Earth, is outside. And working, that kind of like working with your hands, there's a lot of spirituality connected with.
So it is work. Similar to working on a farm.
It's very much that way. It's like a vocation. When you operate a kennel, even a small kennel, it's all these creatures depending on you. If you fall off, if you make mistakes, or if you aren't there to support them, things will fall apart. There's so much work to be done. It's a continuous process running a kennel like that. And I think I got more interested in the spiritual side of being the shepherd because it's brought up a lot in religion. And I think also because our kennel was a specific type of kennel. We were breeding purebred German shepherds for show. And so what I realized is that the common thing above that, the common connection is the caretaking, the operations, the taking care of the animals. What they're for, like what the specific attribute of a kennel is, that's fine. I mean, there's kennels for training, you know, assistive pets, you know, dogs that help non-sighted people and whatnot. There's kennels for security dogs or herding specifically for sheep and that kind of thing, and farm work, that kind of training. There's all kinds of different kennels, security dogs and police dogs, and maybe even hunting. I don't know if German shepherds are used for hunting so much anymore, but I saw our kennel as being specific and also having a connection to all kennels and as you're saying, farms in a lot of ways. So that was really powerful because that's a very American thing, and that agrarian kind of upbringing is, it's really unique, especially to have grown up in a sort of modern Western time in what otherwise would have been suburbia. But yet I had this farm, and it was very spiritual. Like, that was a connection to it. And so it was very much like farming.
So as we head closer, well, we're going to go to actually stay overnight in Vermont and then head tomorrow to Cambridge, New York, which is where the Monks of Newskeet are. So with all of what you said in mind, what do you hope to take back from this monastery and this kennel that we spend several days at?
Wow. Well, I would really, really like to spend some time with some dogs. And I have a feeling there's going to be a few dogs up here.
I should hope so. Yeah, there's going to be a whole bunch. How many dogs can you handle?
Well, I can handle a lot of dogs. And I've been away from it for a long time now. I would say almost almost 10 years. No. That's wrong. Almost 5 years, maybe. I've been well away from having dogs in my life. I've actually been hanging out. It's been wild, but I've been hanging around with a lot more cats than dogs. And I get along with cats. Cats really tend to like me. And, I seem to see cats. I have cats in my building, where I rent. And, I don't know. There's cats all over, really friendly cats. You've got cats in your world that tend to greet me. And so I kind of miss it. What I've realized is that I've been sort of pushing away. I took care of animals for a really, really long time, and it wasn't always easy. Let's not mince words here. I mean, it was very serious work. It was a point of stress and strain in our household at points. There were sad points, and I had a really special dog, and various circumstances led to it leaving my life, and I kind of got turned off to taking care of animals at that point. It was really an uncomfortable situation, and sort of nobody's fault really. But after that, I basically said, "Look, I'm, you know, too grown," and I had some other relatives in my family die, and it was just sort of this transition, and I had to go out and sort of strike out on my own, and basically I vowed away from taking care of animals. I basically said, I'm enough of an animal to take care of at this point, and I'm having to go out and take care of myself. I don't have a family or anything like that, yet, as in a traditional sense, so I basically took a break, a huge break, from what had been a part of my life up until then, the entire time. And really, it struck me 4 years in from being away from that, gosh, you know, the one constant I thought was missing or had changed being a new adult here, was school wasn't going to be a part of my life. But when I really look at what was educational in addition to school, I can definitely say that running a kennel and having animals around me all the time, I miss. And what I've come to is that, and there's a lot of other angles to that to speak about, but what I realize is that I'm an adult and I can set my life up any way I want, and I can revisit this, and I can just handpick the best parts of it that I might want to revisit and have in my life. And I have tremendous insight into how I would do it properly. Because, of course, you always see your parents' mistakes, or you always have a lot of perspective on your upbringing in that. And I'm at a point where I'm starting to consider that. Like, yeah, maybe it would be nice to have a dog, or someday, you know, I'll have a dog, and what would that even be about? And, you know, I wouldn't just do it sort of willy-nilly. That's a serious thing. Even one dog, that's a commitment for a decade or more, and that's another person you have to think about. And I do say person. Dogs have personhood. They're not people as in human, but they are individuals, and they have personalities, and they demand a lot of attention, and you must be willing to accept the responsibility of owning a dog. And I'm getting, like, you know, the feeling when you're on a roller coaster. When I say that, I'm losing my stomach saying that, because I believe that on such a core level.
Might be the road too. It's a bit of a roller coaster of a road here.
Yeah, it could be the road. But I mean, that was like everything that I was brought up to realize. And in like, if example is when we were selling puppies, if a puppy wasn't a show dog, we would sell them as pets. But my mom and my dad would be very rigorous about who is buying this, what kind of yard they have. When I remember my mom taking us on a road trip to repossess a dog,
repossess a dog?
My mother drove us down to Oregon one time. It was a family trip. She said, all right, everybody. And we got in the car and we went to some person's really messed up looking farm out in Oregon. We walked back in the kennel. She walked back in the kennel, found the dog and repossessed the dog. And we were out of there.
But how did she actually go about repossessing the dog, though?
She got out of the car, walked onto the person's property, found the kennel, found the dog, opened it up, walked back, and we got the heck out of there.
Wow.
So
your mom rocks.
Mom is an amazing woman, and my father is an amazing man too. Uh-huh. And it was a family event.
Well, that's the first time I've ever heard that story.
No, that's one. My mom could probably tell it better than me, but she could probably tell you exactly what happened, exactly what dog it was.
Well, how does a dog come to be repossessed in the first place?
Basically, people, when you're selling a pet or selling a show dog, you can have very stringent stuff, criteria for what it would take to actually make the purchase, and you can require things like you must have a fenced yard, and ask all these questions. And in fact, the Monks of Newski, they have a very rigorous application. It's, you know, like 2 or 3 pages long, filling out a questionnaire to build a picture of what this dog's lifestyle will be.
Wow.
Because there's a lot of people that they think they can just get a big dog, a large breed dog, and German Shepherds are large breed dogs. And they think that, oh, it's a cute puppy, and then it becomes a dog.
Mm-hmm.
And then that dog is neglected because it's, A, not a puppy anymore, and, you know, not so cute. It's, you know, old. Maybe it smells funny. And, B, it's a huge responsibility. There's food. There's cleaning. There's a lot to go with that. And in our society, it really falls by the wayside. And people can be a lot trashier than they think, that they don't even see. They're not self-aware, and they can be really not the best place, and they'll even go so far as to misrepresent because they know they're going to be judged. They know that they'll be scrutinized. And so what had happened, I think, is that basically whatever was going on, whatever the arrangement was, it was not to our liking, and we were concerned that the dog would be in an abusive situation. And this person was non-communicative. Maybe they were, there was something in the contract. I don't know what exactly the details were, but there's a lot of factors. And if people don't follow those, you could end up with a dog that dies, you know, that is in a bad situation and is neglected. It's just like, you know, you see on these reality shows or something like that. But for us, it was real. And that was a real story from growing up. And my mom didn't want to be doing that because there's this underbelly in breeding and in dogs. It's a whole spectrum of kennels out there, and it's very expensive. Vets are expensive, and for the rich, it's a hobby, and for the very poor, it's a tough way of life. Just like a lower income spectrum farm household could be, like it's tough. And so if you're not willing to take it on as a hobby, or it's like a, you know, something you know isn't going to be a real profit generating thing, you can make it, but it's going to be rough. And that's just a reality with it. You know, nobody's really getting rich on purebred dogs and that kind of thing. Not that I can see. So that's basically that.
I wonder if the Monks of Newski had ever gone and repo a dog.
I think,
imagine that, having a bunch of monks pull up on your property and grab a dog and speed away.
I think that would be very scary. No, I think
it'd be traumatic. It would be.
I think they would get real serious real quick. You know,
we got to talk to them about
interesting.
That.
I want to tell the story now. That's a good idea. I wonder what they do, but I did read their guidelines, and the Monks of Newski are very particular. I read their application to buy a puppy. Their dogs have something like partial breeding rights, so you cannot breed them to be show dogs, and you cannot buy them to breed, or something to that effect. Or you can buy them to have partial breeding rights, but you cannot breed them outright. You can't just have a female that is a puppy from Newski and then go and have it be a bitch that, you know, can be bred just as a breeding dog. It's in their contract. And their puppies aren't cheap either. They're well over $3,500.
Holy crap, really?
Yeah.
Wow.
That's the baseline. And a good show dog goes for anywhere from like 5 to maybe up to like 8 or even 10. I don't know. I haven't heard double digit dogs, but I'm sure it happens.
See, this is a whole world of dogs that I'm unfamiliar with. My dog didn't cost anything. Just was born on my porch.
Right.
And, you know, many dogs are just dogs you get at the pound or something like this. But show dogs and dogs that are carefully bred and all that kind of thing, it's a whole other world.
Yeah.
And it's fascinating to me that monks at a monastery are involved in this. And I hope we have no idea what to expect, actually. They seem friendly. They invited us up there when we asked if we could come up. But I'm not sure if they're going to want to be interviewed, talk on the radio, or anything like that, or what their demeanor will be.
Yeah.
So I'm really very interested in that angle of the whole thing.
Yeah, I wasn't too particular. I've been communicating with them, and I think they'll be very open to us. I think we have a lot of interesting stories. We have a lot of fun. I'll have plenty to talk about as far as dogs and yes. their impact on my life. And I'm sure you'll be able to share some stories about travels. And
I'll talk about cats and see how that goes.
Yeah, you could probably have a good conversation about cats.
I bet there is a cat.
There might even be a cat or two
yeah.
that has no problem with the dogs there.
And I'm going to get to know that cat. You better believe it.
Because yeah.
the cat probably gets neglected by all the visitors.
Right. Nobody comes to Newskeet to say hi to the cat.
Oh, that's a good name for a band, the Newskeet Cat. You know? Yeah.
Oh,
we're gonna look into this. We'll get all the details.
Yeah, I'm just so thrilled that you're excited and you entertain this. What essentially was a whim, but it's something that struck me. As soon as I found out where exactly the monks of Newskeet were located, I was like, gosh, you know, we might be in the area. And then I just sort of floated it with you. So I'm so glad for you to be open to this, because it's a very deep, like, very important to me. And,
yes.
and I it's sort of part of who I am, but I don't even know these people. And they don't know me necessarily, but...
Well, this is what makes it interesting, isn't it?
I feel a connection, because it was always this one book by the monks of Newskeet that would be referred to in my house. And that was where a lot of the training and positive reinforcement, a lot of those kind of techniques were taught via my mom and my dad, basically raising us to treat animals in this way and to breed obedient and well-tempered German shepherds.
Have you told your family that you're going to see the monks of Newskeet?
Yes, I had to.
How did that go over?
Well, both my parents were really thrilled. My mom is really excited. She was just really into it, and I told her I would tell her all about it and give her a full report. And I would like to bring her out there someday. I think it would be worthwhile for her to see. But I don't know. I mean, we have yet to find out. My father, he thinks it's a pretty fantastic thing, and he actually went and did some research and looked them up. And I think, you know, he's really into it because he knows I'm going with an open mind. And, I mean, I'm not the craziest of religious people, but my father has been through a lot of different things in his life, and he's become a bit more focused on faith in as he's gotten away from sort of the hustle and bustle of the workplace. He's still very busy, but I think he is interested in my interests in meeting and making friends and being associated and learning from people who are devout in their faith. And I think that'll be an interesting way for my father and I to talk, because I don't necessarily talk with him about religion all the time. It's just not a choice. It's not something that's come up for me lately. It's definitely a part of my upbringing, but for him, I think it's really cool to hear that I'm doing this because I'm interested, and it's not because I'm pressured or, you know, you have to go and do this by, you know, anybody's stretch. It was me basically seeing something that was a part of our past that nobody in our family would have thought to investigate, but it's cool. And I, as I reflect, realize that this place this attitude and my story have a lot of connections, in part because the techniques were instilled in the way my family ran our kennel, but also the overlap with faith and things like that, which, again, I'm not, you know, crazy about, but I also, I mean, I respect people that are faithful. And you and I have been to some very spiritual places. I mean, you can go to a religious place and not be on the floor on your knees worshiping and going crazy with the holy water and everything, but we feel it. You feel that energy when you're, no matter what religion, you really feel it, especially traveling. And I think I've opened up more as through travel and through some of our experiences to just saying, like, okay, this is really, really crucial. This is something very important to these people, and we can be a part of it and share with them and talk and relate and be completely reverent and respectful and accepted in our own ways.
And absolutely.
I'm kind of excited for that.
Yeah.
I think we're really going to make some interesting connections and have a lot of fun and play with some dogs.
Oh, yes. Oh, yes. Well, I'm having a great time driving on this road. It's so dark, so empty, so non-commercial, if you will. No trucks or anything like that. And that's the Taconic State Parkway. I can't recommend it highly enough. It's a great alternative to the New York State Thruway. No tolls or anything like that. But that's not the real reason to take it. It happened to be close to where we're going in the first place. But it's just very peaceful, like you're talking about. You're talking about being spiritual, and I'm just sort of meditating. Well, I guess maybe not meditating while I'm driving, but just sort of getting in tune with nature and feeling like it's nighttime and I'm out here in the middle of the woods. And it's a pretty cool feeling, and I hope that's a feeling that we get more of when we're hanging out with these monks for a few days.
It'll be really interesting.
Dog was outside. Well, I was in the kitchen. Shameless mouth was outside. Well, the sun sinks slowly. My old hand flips out right down.
Listening to the first of two shows that focus on the monks of Newskeet and the German shepherds they raise at their monastery in upstate New York. Next week on Off the Wall, we'll arrive at the monastery, we'll meet some dogs, and we'll talk to one of the monks about their whole operation. Don't forget, you can write to us at otw@2600.com. For Off the Wall, this is Emmanuel. Have a good night.
friends, my friends. This is Finn, and this is Finn's Revolution right here on WUSB Stony Brook, 7 to 9 p.m. Anything can happen. I don't know exactly what's going to. You can take your wagers and listen up, because I have no idea what we're about to do, but it's going to be weird. Hold on to your seats. We'll be right back. there, a little Los Straitjackets from Jet Set. Before that, the of course, the Flamin' Groovies. Now let's talk about the weather, Francoise.
Broken windows and empty hallways. Pale dead moon in a sky streaked with gray. Human kindness overflowing.